Welcome to the podcast. This podcast will be concentrating on America, the USA, Uncle Sam, Land of the Free, though that doesn't, of course, apply to healthcare. I don't know why we are focusing on the USA. Nothing much seems to be happening there. All is well with their political system and their foreign policy, isn't it? What do you mean, war? War? With the commies? Again? There are commies. Not those commies. What do you mean? Oh, God. Anyway, though most of the contributions mention that small American democracy called the USA, our first contribution is from Priya on her ungagged debut, a sex worker from Glasgow and a volunteer for Umbrella Lane, speaking on the laws surrounding sex work and repercussions of those laws. M. Dehaney kicks off the American theme with a piece about not having been to America. From our North American ungagged team, Chuck Hamilton will be talking about how we disemboweled our revolution for a pair of trainers and why he is proud to be unconventional Alex the Dead Guy. Two of Radio KRFP studios in Northwest America, George Parks and Eileen Eddy, will be talking about American cultural and political imperialism. Wee Rafe is glad the First Minister of Scotland did not meet with Trump but did real work over in America and asks, just what did happen to that big onion? Deborah Torrance is on the similarities with the present world order and the 80s, Thatcher Reagan years. She refers to Victoria Pearson's epic rant. If you haven't read it, over 500,000 people have, and it's on our facebook.com/ungagged page. Simone Charlesworth, in her ungagged debut on Sean Spicer, the use of gas by Nazi Germany and the history of sarin, and Steve McAuliffe delivers a cool poem about America the First. All of the details you need to know about our contributors and our music is on our website, leftungagged.wordpress.com. If you hated every word of this, or loved bits, hated other bits, or just loved the whole jing bang, contact us and let us know. We need to know how to improve, what to change, what to keep, and what to give a lick of emulsion over. We are on Facebook, as I already mentioned, and on Twitter, @_ungagged. Oh, and speaking of music, we cut the brilliant Babelfish Project's piece short last time due to a technical difficulty with the music file. Later in the podcast, you'll hear the whole brilliant Will You Go Lassie Go. Anyway, this is XSLF with a track off their new album. This is Words. Say what you don't mean.
name is Priya. I'm a sex worker and I'm also a volunteer for Umbrella Lane, which is a Glasgow-based peer-run sex worker project and organisation. I'm here to talk to you about the laws surrounding sex work and their repercussions. So you may have recently heard about SMP. The SMP have backed a motion to support the criminalisation of sex work clients. It's also commonly referred to as the Swedish model or the Nordic model. So in discussions around sex work, there are people who think that or who believe that sex work is something that is inherently exploitative or violent, and that it's a degrading job, and that no one willingly chooses to enter into the industry. I obviously have objections to this argument, but I think that's a different discussion to have. Let's put aside those kind of moral objections at this moment and accept that we live in a society where people do choose sex work for various reasons, typically because of the attractive wages and the fact that it gives people time, flexibility and control over their lives. So sex workers exist and they work, and the job under the current climate of capitalism isn't going to change. And oftentimes when people have these kind of debates, a claim that's brought up is, or a question that's brought up by people who wish to criminalise sex work in whatever model, might say, you wouldn't want your daughter doing this job. And I think that's the wrong question to ask. I think the question should be, my child is doing this job. Do I want them to be safe? So what is the law currently surrounding sex work? Well, sex work is currently legal to buy and sell. So it's legal to buy sex and it's legal to sell sex. But there are other surrounding laws, such as the fact that two workers can't work under the same premises. This constitutes a brothel, and that is illegal. Now, this is a problem in and of itself. Sex workers typically like to work together under the same roof for reasons of safety, in case they have a dangerous client or a client who will commit crimes such as rape, sexual violence, theft, etc. Typically, a sex worker will feel more comfortable having somebody there in case things go downhill. And also, street-based sex workers, clients are criminalised. We'll talk about that later, about what consequences that has. So what are the repercussions of the Nordic model? So I'm going to paraphrase from a document by Scott Pepp. Scott Pepp are an organisation that's based in Edinburgh and they lobby for the full decriminalisation of sex work. So their document discusses how this form of criminalisation harms sex workers, whether they willingly enter the industry or not. So by that I mean people who choose to do sex work and also those who are trafficked. And I think a very important point to make is that according to research, this model does not reduce the number of people who actually enter the sex industry. It only exposes them to more violence and danger. So when we look at street-based work, clients are currently criminalised under the law that we have at the moment. Because clients fear arrest, they are more inclined to make the initial contact hurried so they aren't seen. And the sex worker has to oblige with this if they want to make money. So because of this, they have less time to assess whether this particular client could be dangerous, and they have less time to discuss things like rates or condom use. Obviously, the sex worker will want to avoid any kind of police interference, so they might work at more unsociable hours and maybe under more pressure to see clients who are drunk or drugged and potentially violent. Scott Pepp saw a 50% increase in reports of violence after street clients were criminalized. This evidence is backed up by research from the Home Office and the Norwegian government, who note that those who are affected the most are drug addicts, the mentally ill, trafficked sex workers, immigrants, etc. Now, when we look at indoor sex work, a common police tactic is for them to surveil sex workers' homes in order to arrest clients. This means that clients may be less willing to see a sex worker in the sex worker's property, and they would prefer them to come to them, the client's home. And this can sometimes put the sex worker in a potentially dangerous situation. You would understand why you would prefer to see a stranger in your own home as opposed to going to where they live. As the sex industry is unable to be practiced openly, it's pushed underground, which results in pimps gaining more control and sex workers becoming more reliant on them. The police also find it more difficult to investigate actual cases of trafficking and pimping because of this. The head of Sweden's anti-trafficking unit stated, and I'm going to quote them here, they said, "Of course the law has negative consequences for women in prostitution, but that's also some of the effect that we want to achieve with the law. For people who are still being exploited in prostitution, the above negative effects of the ban that they describe must be viewed as positive from the perspective that the purpose of the law is indeed to combat prostitution." So I'm going to make this very clear here. The proponents of the Nordic model want to end the industry, and it has been implemented with the aim to make sex workers' lives more difficult in order to act as a deterrent. So this means that they are putting sex workers' lives on the line, essentially. These people are collateral damage for the sake of their ideology. So proponents of the Nordic model accuse Decrim supporters of wanting to protect clients. That's one of the accusations that's often leveled towards us, which is, as I've discussed, is untrue, as the law only puts sex workers in more danger. And another thing that we're often accused of being is being the people who support decriminalization are accused of being privileged happy hookers who are not willing to fight for more marginalized people. And this is also untrue. As I've discussed before, the Nordic model hurts the most vulnerable and marginalized people first, such as immigrants, the homeless, drug users, single parents, people in abusive relationships, anyone who relies on their earnings more. They now lose that kind of power, and they might accept more dangerous clients, more violent clients, unsafe sex practices in order to put food on the table. So anti-sex work feminists argue that no one chooses sex work freely, but under our current economic climate and the climate of austerity, this choice is often the most sensible. So should we be targeting our ire at the sex trade? No, we should be targeting our ire at the cuts to support for domestic violence, for example. We should be opposing zero-hour contracts, etc. So hopefully I've helped you understand why the Nordic model and what the SNP have backed is a very, very dangerous idea, and that it will put sex workers' lives at risk, and that it's in essence a very moralizing law that doesn't actually consider the repercussions of what the law will entail. I'd encourage anyone who wants to find out more on the subject to visit Scott Pepp's website, which is www.scott-pepp.org.uk, for more information. And you can donate as well, because because funding is very low. There's lots of information there about legal models and what their effects are. Please do get in touch if you'd like any more information or you would like to volunteer. Thank you.
Pulling 10 till 8 at Rennie's, it was driving me berserk. and that stop for 20 pennies on the way back home from work. When shuffle sent a song my way I hadn't heard in years. Complete control compounding out, and I fought back the tears. It must have been November, 'cause me dad was still at home when the clash hit Borough Town Hall with that riot all the wrong. We'd spiked our hair with soap and we'd sewn zips into our jeans. Looking back, we had a much of nothing but our dreams. There was me and Jack and Johnny and a stolen bottle of gin. We didn't have a penny, but the band they let us in. Took me 30 years to see it on a number 19 bus. The clash didn't smash the town hall, nor the clash didn't smash the town hall, nor the clash didn't smash the town hall. That was us. There was Mick and Paul and Topper, and in the center of the stage there was Strummer backing orders in that mystic kind of rage. This was our rebel army, and they come to take our town. We let out all our anger and we tore the damn place down. There was me and Jack and Johnny and a stolen bottle of gin. We didn't have a penny, but the band they let us in. Took me 30 years to say it on a number 19 bus. The clash didn't smash the town hall. Us. But the band are dead and gone now, and I thought I was too. Ah, but Strummer woke up something when he shouted, "That means you." And I jacked my job at Rennie's. What I'll do now, I don't know. But I owed it to the young man I was all them years ago. And the moral of this story is you've one life, don't you blow it. Yeah, and anyone can change the world, it's just most of us don't know it. Yeah, to live life like you mean it, or you rack up more regrets. And I'm 53 next Friday, ah, but I am finished, yeah. Took me 30 years to see it on a number 19 bus. Clashed in smash town hall, not a clashed in smash the town hall, not a clashed in smash the town hall. That was us.
My name is Em Dehaney and I have never been to America. I've never been to America, but I have walked the steam-vented mean streets of New York, ridden in the yellow taxis and tasted the mustard-covered hot dogs. I've gambled with gangsters and seen a city grow from the blood of immigrants, all thanks to Martin Scorsese. I've never been to America, but I have stood under endless Yosemite skies and seen the moon rise through the lens of Ansel Adams. I've never been to America, but I've felt heat from the sun-baked alleys of Compton and learned the poetry of oppression and violence through the words of Tupac and N.W.A. I've looked inside myself, understood my depression and my fears and anxieties through the prism of Sylvia Plath. I've seen the beauty of street art through the eye of Jean-Michel Basquiat. I've heard the rhythm of survival, courage and freedom in the writings of Maya Angelou. I've listened to Motown and Lou Reed and Patti Smith and the Ramones and Nirvana and Hole and the whole soundtrack to my teenage years on cassette tapes recorded in basement studios in Seattle, New York, LA and Detroit. America has given us blues, jazz, hip-hop, graffiti, punk, grunge. It has given us art through adversity. It has given us beauty through struggle. And it continues to give. Saturday Night Live now regularly lampooning the shit show that is the Trump administration. Teen Vogue, the surprise bastion of intelligent resistance. And thousands of voices on Twitter. And Beyonce and Lady Gaga bringing race and gender politics into the homes of millions of Americans watching the Super Bowl. It gives us the Dakota Access Pipeline protests and the Pussy Power March. It gives us films like Get Out and Moonlight. America has seen the darkest of times. Colonialism, slavery, segregation, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy. America is the only nation to have used atomic weapons in war. America has a list of crimes against humanity as long as its troubled history. And now America seems to be run by an embarrassing coterie of ignorant bootlickers, Holocaust deniers, racists, bigots, misogynists and religious fundamentalists. But there will always be American artists telling their stories through film, music, comedy and poetry, fighting the power, bringing the noise, singing from inside the cage, raging against the machine. I've never been to America, but it will always be in my heart.
To stink up my air is wrong.
There is no evolution that generates spin off pollution. Suspend your disbelief or you'll throw what you have seen. Do you have excuse because I'm seen? What they're useless. We are told we should be out. We are told we should breathe. Why don't they? This is working out. This is what we should be talking about. Why don't they? We close our eyes. This is where you've been to way and high. Dolly Fools photograph. Give me like a psychopath.
Hello, this is Chuck Hamilton coming to you once again from Chattanooga, Tennessee in the USA, also known as Neverland, Wonderland, and the Great Satan. This time I'm bringing you a Watershed of Chill 2.0. He said there is no reason, and the truth is plain to see. This piece is a bridge from one I first wrote back in 2008 and have redone with different titles, this being the latest. This current name comes from one of my all-time favorite movies, 1983's The Big Chill, and one of the songs featured in it, Procol Harum's A Whiter Shade of Pale from 1967, the quote with which I began is a verse from the latter. The film The Big Chill is about a group of friends who attended the University of Michigan in the late 1960s and considered themselves part of the movement against war, for women's liberation, for the war on poverty, against segregation, for civil rights, etc. But in the end, it turned out that they were just role-playing trendy revolution following fashion, and the illusion never changed into something real. The action in the movie takes place a decade and a half later, after their ideals have withered and the cosplay yuppies have all become yuppies. An industrialist, a high-end doctor, a TV action star, a corporate attorney, a writer for People magazine, a wife to an accountant married for security, and a drug dealer to the wealthy. They had all fallen down like the toy soldiers they really were. The catalyst for the story was the suicide of the one member of their clique who was still trying to live by those formerly professed ideals. Alex Marshall, the dead guy in question, was Kevin Costner's first movie role. The original opening scene, later cut, had him in the bathtub bleeding, but still alive. In the release, all we saw was his body, no face, as the mortician was dressing him for the funeral home, the last shot being that of his slit but now sewn up wrists. Alex was the true believer, the one person in the group who really believed the things he was saying, the principles they espoused, and continued searching and believing long after he left the university and the others had gone on with their yuppie lives. Everyone I knew enjoyed the movie, but the baby boomers and Gen Xers, Generation Xers, had different takes. To the boomers, the movie showed that ideals weren't as important as friendship and that trading principles for cash was just pragmatic common sense. For me and my fellow Gen Xers, how most of us felt is best summed up in the words of Winona Ryder's character in the opening scene of the 1993 movie Reality Bites. Quote, "The baby boomers wonder why we aren't interested in their counterculture that they invented, as if we didn't see them disembowel their revolution for a pair of running shoes," end quote. Running shoes at the time were one of the motifs of the yuppie stereotype. They were even featured in the movie, in fact. The aforementioned industrialist manufactured them and gave out some to all of the characters in the movie in one scene. One of the many conversations my friends and I had about the movie figured in one of the more memorable series of events from when I was at UTC. One evening, I was being given a ride home late one afternoon by a female friend with whom I was having a date that next weekend. I forget the reason exactly that I needed a ride that day, but it may have been after Sunday Mass at the Newman Center. Mary, the girl driving, and I had both seen The Big Chill, her twice, me four times, and were discussing it. As we passed out of the tunnel through Missionary Ridge from Macaulay Avenue in downtown Chattanooga onto Brainerd Road, Mary half turned to me and asked, "Who do you see yourself as? Which one of the characters?" I replied. "I guess I'd have to say Nick." Nick, played by William Hurt, was the cynical drug dealing anti-authoritarian former psychology student and war vet who had lost his genitalia, or at least the function thereof, in Vietnam. "Why Nick?" "Well, he's so cynical, and so am I." "Well, you're as cynical," she answered, "but that's not who I would say." "Oh? Who do you see me as?" Keeping one eye on the road, she looked at me sideways with a funny look in her eyes and said, "Alex." "Alex," I thought. "The dead guy?" So I asked, "Alex, the dead guy?" She told me she was talking about the things the other characters said about him, all their memories, the way he had touched their lives. It wasn't a dead guy she was comparing me to. It was the memories of that dead guy. She wasn't casting me for zombie apocalypse, at least. For my marriage date that weekend in 1983, we went to a Sicilian-owned restaurant in Brainerd Village Shopping Center, Mama Teresa's. Very intimate atmosphere, delicious food, great wine, then to a movie. Typical dinner and a movie date, but the conversation At dinner was fantastic, lively, and engaging. All in one of the best just-a-date dates I have ever had to that point. I couldn't get Mary on the phone for the next 3 weeks after our dinner and a movie, nor did she show up at the center on Sundays. When she finally did show up for Sunday evening mass there after 3 weeks, she came up to me and said with no preamble, "I'm sorry, but things between us would never work out. I'm too conventional for you." Conventional. 1. Following generally or accepted principles, methods, and behavior. 2. Ordinary, commonplace. 3. Lacking originality or individuality. 4. Typical, stereotypical. 5. Conformist. I just stood there with my mouth open. What do you say to something like that? After a time, Mary and I did get back to being pretty good friends again, but for a while it was pretty awkward. She never explained or gave me any hint of what had brought her to that conclusion after just one date, and it wasn't exactly like we didn't know each other. Mary graduated UTC and University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and began teaching at Notre Dame, the local Catholic high school, which was her alma mater. She had graduated there in 1980, a class ahead of my best friend at UTC. A few months after she started working there, I got a call from her asking if I wanted to come to her wedding, and if so, she'd send me an invitation. The 22-year-old, too conventional for me, Catholic girl was marrying a 38-year-old divorcee who had a 19-year-old daughter, and she had called me unconventional. Unconventional, 1. Not adhering to accepted standards, 2. Out of the ordinary, 3. Dissident, unorthodox, heretical, 4. Atypical, 5. Nonconformist, maverick. "Sure," I replied. "I'll go. Why not?" The wedding was surreal. The only person whom I knew there was Mary, my friend, and one time literally, date. I ended up slow dancing very closely with her new 19-year-old stepdaughter, Darley, which her boyfriend, whom I hadn't known about, didn't seem to appreciate, though he took it out on her rather than me, by delivering her to her grandmother, me in tow. What ensued was a lot of screaming and yelling and scolding, in Cuban Spanish. No one paid me any attention. It turns out Darley was not happy about having a stepmother only 2 years her senior, but she wasn't pissed at Mary, she was pissed at her dad. So she had overindulged in refreshments at the wedding reception. A couple of weeks later, Mary was fired from Notre Dame High School on grounds of moral turpitude for having married a divorcee by the same organization, the Catholic Church, that has provided so much aid, comfort, support, and shelter to the kitty fuckers in its ranks all over the world, with the cooperation of some of the people in its highest echelons, including the head of the Inquisition, later known as Pope Benedict XVI. Before that, though, I had called Darley, my friend Mary's new stepdaughter, 2 nights after the wedding, and the two of us wound up dating on and off for several months. As for those ideals I spoke of, espoused by the baby boomers of the new left, the millennials, whom so many boomers and Gen Xers scorn and belittle, are their second coming. Only, unlike their predecessors, they really mean it. Thank you, Abagubra, Igar Laha, our day will come. Keep the faith. Peace out. Your mother's skin.
Hello, all you good folks out there. George Collins coming to you from the KRFP studios here in northern Idaho of the Pacific Northwest. I remember being in my junior year of high school. That was the year that I began learning about U.S. history. Or I shouldn't say that. It wasn't beginning learning about it. It was enrolling in the comprehensive course. And I was in AP history or advanced placement. So thankfully, I was divorced from a lot of the state biases that will conveniently leave all kinds of facts out of history textbooks. For that reason, I'm very glad I did not do my education in the state of Texas. And I remember during that time, as I began to learn more about the ways in which American culture and identity were shaped at various points in the country's history, it dawned on me that I didn't fully understand what they were talking about. Sure, I knew that what it meant as it applied to things like American literature and music and things of that nature. But the whole notion of an American culture made no sense to me even at the time. And even when I got into college, I would meet other folks who felt a similar way. We would say, well, isn't the whole identity of the United States based on that being a nation of immigrants, the coming together of a bunch of unique cultures and the expression of those cultures, at least on paper? I don't actually believe that that's the case, and I think a case could be made against that, but that's the idea. So how could you have a distinctly American culture if the whole idea of, quote, America in the first place was everyone celebrating their own unique culture? And it wasn't until I got out of the country, both to Canada and in my travels to Europe, that I started to realize what exactly that meant. And that the reason I could not conceive of an American culture is because through a legacy of imperialism and capitalism, it had gotten itself into everything. I think back to looking at images of, in particular, this one I remember in apartheid South Africa, and of looking at the black South Africans that were horribly oppressed under that regime, all wearing what we would deem as, quote, Western clothing. And I don't bring up that juxtaposition to suggest that these people are inherently uncivilized and that such an appearance seems weird, but to look at that presentation and understand the reasons behind it, with the brutal and Djangoistic legacy, especially on the African continent, and to realize these elements of Western culture exist all over the world because of that Djangoistic history. So I find myself sitting here today realizing that, yes, there is in fact an American culture. But the ways in which it was spread to non-American people have not always been very honorable. In fact, have not often been very honorable. And there's the obvious consequence of that, again, with it being a brutal history. I also feel like in a way that has inversely affected me and a lot of my fellow Americans in our awareness of the rest of the world. I was talking to my father about this not too long ago, and he said, go up to any person on the street here in the United States and see if they can name the last monarch who served before Queen Elizabeth II. I can do it, George VI, but before that, that's where I get lost as well. And when I think about my history curriculum, we didn't learn about Canadian history. We didn't learn about Mexican history. There are two neighbors to the north and south whose history has influenced our own in a lot of ways. Now, sure, we learned about English history, you know, up until a convenient year of 1776, and then it mysteriously ends for some reason. Golly gee, I wonder what happened then. Now we have a proposed solution for this that we often throw out in the United States, and that's to travel more, to get out more. You know, if you can afford it, that is. It's not exactly a habit that you pay for with pocket change. But even that can get flimsy at times, because there's plenty of evidence to suggest that many countries around the world tailor their tourist trades not to how they actually think and behave, but to what they think Americans want to see. I'll never forget one of my professors in college talking about going down to the Caribbean with his wife, who's of from a country down in the Caribbean, and I can't recall which one at the time, but it was one of those countries. And he talked about going there and being invited into people's houses. But he was aware that one of the taboos of this culture was to not enter other people's houses until you had begun to know them intimately. Being invited into someone's house was treated as like a rite of passage, if you will, an establishment of trust. And these people have never seen this guy before, and they're just letting him in. So at one point, he finally asks somebody about this, and he says, I don't really get what's going on here. I was under the impression that this was just not something was done. And this person's response, apparently verbatim, according to this professor, was, no, see, it's okay. You're American. And I have to be honest, it's been hard to come to terms with that at times as I've sought to learn more about the world, especially geopolitics, when so much of the information that I obtain has to be filtered through this place that I've been born and raised in. And that's true of any country's media, of course, but with the way that American culture has seeped into everything, for better or for worse, it is a uniquely difficult stranglehold to break out of. And as I've been thinking about this, especially as it relates to this week's theme, it gave me a newfound gratitude for being able to participate in this podcast of Ungagged, to be able to familiarize myself with the politics of the United Kingdom and the rest of the world through the lens of people who don't have to pass through that filter. American culture may be everywhere, and existing as an American in this world can sometimes feel like being the fish that doesn't know that water exists until you physically take it out of the water to show it a different plane. So I guess what I'm trying to say is thank you to all you listeners for listening to my broadcast each time an Ungagged edition comes up, and for allowing me the opportunity to be part of this community, because I can guarantee you that it's as enlightening for me, if not more so, than anything I could possibly bring to you. So thank you for that, and may the road rise with you. Hey folks, George Collins here again, excited to introduce a guest contributor from the Ungagged America branch from the KRFP studios. Eileen Eddy is about to stir some soup.
Just as Colin was mentioning that American culture is ambient and most people don't actually realize it and the effects that we have on the rest of the countries around the world and how our culture is not actually absent from our foreign policies and our values, I think that we should talk about our American culture and our foreign policy. Everyone knows over the last week that President Trump deployed 60 Tomahawk missiles to Syria in order to fight a claimed gas attack by Bashar al-Assad. However, what that news media left out was the fact that the American public has been at war for over 15 years, and that we are tired of war. The American taxpayer has bore the brunt of not only the physical and psychological scars of these foreign wars we've had in Afghanistan and Iraq, but we've also bore a significant reputation due to the fact that a recent Gallup poll of, I think, several hundred countries named the U.S. as the greatest threat to world peace. And of course, as an American, I don't want my country to have that reputation tied to it. I think that we need to have an honest and frank discussion about foreign policy and American values, because we are never going to actually fix this country and make it truly great unless we've talked about its past and how to change its future, because the U.S. is honestly at a crossroads. Our infrastructure is crumbling. 50% of our population is in poverty and makes less than $30,000 a year. And yet we have trillions of dollars to have foreign wars abroad. And I think most Americans don't know that half of our population is in poverty. Or if they do know, that's probably why they voted for President Trump, because of his anti-war attitude that he had on the campaign trail. He was basically saying that we're going to basically focus more on home, fix the problems that we have at home, and actually, people have been expecting him to do such a thing. However, foreign policy has recently taken the focus from what would otherwise be President Trump actually talking about our domestic policies and how he can actually implement some policies that will be to the benefits of most Americans. What Americans, I think, don't really understand about foreign policy is that they think that people hate us for our values. However, that could not be more mistaken, because, in fact, most of the world, and the Middle East in particular, which we've been at war at 15 years, know the history of our country and our military's invasions and coup d'etats of various governments in the Middle East. But Americans, however, do not know that. And that's another reason why there is a lot of rampant anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, and anti-Islamic bigotry and hatred and xenophobia. What Americans also do not know is that we have been in the Middle East since the 1950s, overthrowing governments because multinationals have wanted Americans to have easy access to oil. And when countries that were secular and democratic but otherwise did not want to give us oil or sell it to us through BP, we did regime change, for example, in Iran. In 1953, the CIA overthrew a democratically elected government of Mossadegh and replaced him with the Shah of Iran. And the Shah of Iran was a brutal dictator who eventually was overthrown in 1979. And the people elected a theocratic government, which is Shia fundamentalist. And ever since we did military interventions to overthrow our former ally Saddam Hussein, we have actually aided Iran, which the U.S. has claimed as its enemy for the last almost 40 years. More important than that, we have to make our foreign policy more about just doing proxies between Iran and Saudi Arabia, because there's no way we're going to be free from the threat of ISIS or other extremists, either lone wolf or otherwise, unless we have a true conversation about our military involvement in the Middle East. I mean, Iran wasn't the only Middle Eastern country we've tried to overthrow in the last 50 to 100 years. We've tried to overthrow the governments of Egypt, Syria, which we're currently involved in as of now, and pretty much almost every country who had a secular government that did not want us to either put in a pipeline or other things like that, we have actually overthrown their governments. In fact, in Afghanistan had a thriving democracy in the middle 70s. However, we overthrew that democracy in a proxy war with the Soviet Union. And actually, the CIA propped up what would later become a Taliban, which we've been fighting for the last 15 years, but we can't actually keep fighting that because we aren't winning. America truly needs to have great values, and to truly be great, we need to acknowledge these harms that we've done toward people, not just in the Middle East, but all over the planet, and we need to stop being the global policemen in this planet, and to actually put the rights of the people that we claim to be liberating first, rather than other dictators that we've propped up around the planet and cause the suffering of multiple people on multiple continents. I think the most important thing that Americans need to realize from the Syria strike is that it frankly is not as important as to whether or not Bashar al-Assad actually did the gas attack as it is that the reason why we're there, when we hate both sides of the people who are fighting a civil war currently there, is that we're there because there are competing pipelines that Russia and Kuwait want to actually put through Syria that Bashar al-Assad did not want. And therefore, we have done interventions in Syria when we don't actually have much reason to do so, or the understanding that if we topple yet another dictator in the Middle East, and frankly, we've done 7 military interventions over the last 8 years of President Obama's presidency, that if you keep doing interventions without a functioning government, you're going to just have more failed states. And that's going to cause more Americans to be at risk of terrorism than actually defeating it, because it's hard to fight an idea. But we need to make sure that we educate the public and inform them about these important facts in order to truly make America great again, and to stop fighting in places in which we don't like either governments. So I think that the U.S. should frankly, of course, fight ISIS, but I believe that Assad is a whole other matter which should be dealt with diplomatically, because frankly, neither side is above critique in this actual discussion about Syria and, you know, who's done more war crimes, because frankly, both sides have done war crimes. Both sides have gassed each other. I believe the rebels and Assad have both gassed their own people. And frankly, we should get rid of all chemical weapons. But frankly, we need to get rid of ISIL first and then have a political discussion, because otherwise we risk the having an actual failed state in it and a possible escalation to World War III, which would be a terrible decision, especially since we aren't just at risk of that happening in just one country. It's also a important risk of happening in North Korea right now, which is also a very delicate matter because they have nuclear weapons and frankly a leader who is not afraid to use them and is not completely mentally sound. So I think that the U.S. needs to actually realize that we need to keep educating people about this. We need to have the progressive agenda of Bernie Sanders domestically, and as part of our education, we need to have to educate people about what we do abroad in our foreign policy, but also that we can fix it by simply serving the American people and the people and the other countries in which we wish to liberate by actually, most oftentimes, not actually getting involved, unless there is a serious crisis which would actually deem our intervention. Because frankly, in 15 or 16 years, ever since 9/11, we have been constantly at war, and we've honestly been creating more terrorists than we've been defeating. And that is, of course, contrary to what America and American values actually want. And we need to be better at realizing that our culture and our values mean something when we sell them abroad, but people don't believe us because, for example, we've been using weapons that cause cancer and governments being overthrown, but rather environmental damage, such as using depleted uranium tips in Syria, Iraq, and other countries. We also need to realize that American values are best utilized with peace instead of war. Peace is what we should be trying to achieve because we can truly make America great again with progressive values if we push President Trump to actually have no other option to do that than to do so, both domestically and abroad. Thank you.
Socialist cause. I've just been in at Kirk's. See that big onion I telling you about last week? Somebody knocked it out his shed. Kirk's a pacifist, but he's fit to be tied. His mammy was going to make French onion soup with it, and I was invited round to get some. I'm not French, by the way. They're German. But the People's Republic of my street's proudly European, diverse, and all cosmopolitan. A perfect stick man. But we just no bother with him. Now, I'm not saying it was him that knocked Kirk's precious onion, but I can't think of anybody else that would do it. We're going to sneak round after and see if he's all cooking up a bowl of treachery. And so that's Theresa May triggered a cheeky wee Article 50, and now swanning around all the despots of the world, trying to rope us into trade deals with him. Lovely, eh? Young folks' rights to live, work and love across the whole EU has been traded for shady dealings with Saudi Arabia, Turkey and old fezziwiggy sell Donald Trump. Oh, no, get me started on him again. Our First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, was away off on a trip to the States the other day. We wasn't worried that she'd sign some mad deal with him. We were just all concerned that she'd have to meet with him at all. She didn't, though, thank God. Just doing her day job, promoting the greatness of Scotland to the rest of the world. But when Trump comes for his state visit, the one Theresa May daftly roped us into, he is coming to Scotland, and our Nicola's going to have no choice but to have to meet with him. Because like I know, she's a stateswoman, and part of her job is having to meet Egypts like him. As trusting the good folk of Scotland to give him a traditional Scottish welcome, I want reserved for ball bags and warmongers. Anywho, I'd better go now. Text off a wee Vinnie. Apparently Stickman's cooking a big pot of something that smells fishily like onions. Tune in next time and I'll tell you what happened. I mean, I can go down.
Hi, it's Deborah Torrens from Ogai. I'm meeting up with an American family this week, or next week, or something. They're visiting from Maryland. They love Scotland. I feel sorry for America with all their Trumping adventures they know. But we're no better with our own Prime Minister Theresa May away skipping over there to hold his tiny hand. I asked on Twitter recently if May was worse than Thatcher. The results actually shocked me. From 309 respondents, 53% said, hell yeah. 34% said there were some similarities. 7% said, hell no. And 6% dunno. Personally, I just thought, aye, there are some similarities. Thatcher loved Nixon. May seems to love Trump. They're both women. Obviously, that's a pretty big in-your-face, easy-to-make comparison, and they both happen to be Tories. Let's dig a little deeper, though. Let's see what impacts their policies have had. So, since I'm a child of the 80s from Glasgow, I'm going to kick things off here with a policy that incriminated my brother and made my mum a pariah in the local post office. Yep, I'm talking about the one and only riot-inducing, unfair, geographically specific poll tax. Or at least the Scottish trials of it, since it was seen fit to test it on us unruly Scots for a year before anywhere else. A tax on being, well, alive and a registered to vote adult. My brother, who was a young man at the time, refused to pay it. Meanwhile, my mum, who always follows the rules, held up an East End post office while she was paying hers and my dad's poll tax, often to jeers from the queue of, "Oh, for fuck's sake, she's paying a bloody poll tax!" A single flat rate per capita tax set by the local authority. So that's one of Thatcher's legacies. Is there anything comparable with May? Well, as it happened, since May has been Prime Minister, we've seen some of the most dramatic declines of the social security system in Britain ever. There's a tax on having a spare bedroom, irrelevant if you're elderly or disabled. You might now not be elderly or disabled enough to be exempt, or if you're split from another parent of your child or have children of different genders and ages, they can share a bedroom so the government can tax the other. That's pretty diabolical. What else has she been up to? Well, taking disability vehicles off of up to 900 sick and disabled folk a week. Telling people who can't walk 50 metres that it's alright, they aren't disabled anymore because the Tories changed the international standard definition for no apparent reason. Now it's 30 metres that you can't be able to walk in order to qualify for the highest rate of mobility. Now is this going to save millions of pounds? No, not really, because these people are still fucking disabled and still need the help and support that you, Theresa May, and your Tory government has decided to take away. So now your magically healed 56-year-old with chronic arthritis, who can sometimes walk 50 metres, doesn't have their car. They still have to go to the hospital appointments, but now they have to spend their benefit money on expensive taxis or get hospital transport, which, guess what, puts more strain on an already extremely stressed ambulance service. That person who last week was disabled is still disabled, even though the government has decided not disabled enough. Aye, I'm getting annoyed and I might have swore a little because of Victoria Pearson, her epic rant involved swearing. She sort of inspired me. Maybe it's because I'm disabled myself that I've been through this rigorous test in the PIP. I was terrified. I'd read all the horror stories. I'd panicked for many a sleepless night after filling in a novel-length application form. I was lucky, though. My assessor had previously worked at the neurological department in my local hospital. She was familiar with my health condition and even knew my specialist nurse. I was okay. But there are too many tales of folk who aren't okay, who get so stressed by the interrogation, because that's what it is, an interrogation, they couldn't continue, which in some cases resulted in a fail, meaning no more money, no more support, and no aid in appealing the decision. I've also purposely not mentioned the heinous rape clause for tax credits because I quite like my keyboard, and this sentence alone is taking the toll of angry typing, and I'm saying it through gritted teeth. So now, being disabled in 2017 is a bit like being a minor in the 80s. We're forced to be judged. We're portrayed in the media as scroungers or as hope-inspiring heroes, depending on whether you're a Paralympian or not, maybe. I don't know. There seems to be no in-between. Disabled people are the scabs of today's society. There are worthy disabled and unworthy. And like the public back in the 80s, some put tins of beans in a collection bin for those unfortunate enough not to have been deemed worthy enough for help from the state and now have to rely on food banks. We have to fight for our rights, even now. All before the European Human Rights Act is repealed and we hurtle down the Brexit cliff. Another surely enduring legacy of Mrs. May's. So is May worse than Thatcher? She hasn't sent armed forces to a distant colony yet. Hola, Gibraltar, ¿cómo está? And she hasn't had riots like that at the scale of the miners' rights Thatcher faced in her hands as a result of her unjust policies yet. But then, there's still time for her to make her mark. And since we have new friends that like to play with their Moabs, and I'm not talking about Trump's man boobs here, we have to watch how our new relations influence our country. So back to the West Side Story, eh? La 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 America, la 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 America, la 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 America, la 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 America.
Oh, the summer time is coming, and the trees are sweetly blooming, and the wild mountain time all around the bloom. Go, and we'll all go together to the wild mountainside from around the blooming heather. Will he go? Lassie,
I'm Simone Charlesworth, and I live in Glasgow. This podcast theme is America, which is something I don't usually blog about. However, one piece of news this week got me doing some research. On Tuesday, Sean Spicer, Trump's ill-equipped press secretary, when talking about Assad and Syria, said, "We didn't use chemical weapons in World War II. Someone who is despicable as Hitler, who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons." He then attempted to clarify it with, "I think when you come to sarin gas, Hitler was not using gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. He brought them into the Holocaust Center, I understand that, but I'm saying in the way that Assad used them, where he went into towns, dropping them down into the middle of towns. It was bought, the use of it. Holocaust centres. That's an interesting way to describe the gas chambers. Honestly, I'm trying hard not to be crass here, but it sounds like somewhere you ring on a free phone number, followed by, press 1 for... This man is the spokesperson for the President of the United States. Now, I know he can't be an expert in everything, but surely he's briefed before facing the press. So I thought I would see what I could find out. This is a fraction of the information I found in minutes after a quick search on Google. I'm guessing, hoping, the US intelligence services have better resources. Firstly, the Holocaust. It has been calculated that 6 million Jews were killed. Over 1 million died in ghettos and camps, similar numbers in mass executions, and 3,652,000 in the gas chambers. Even if you do discount the majority of Jewish victims as not being his people, which is frankly a ridiculous excuse, it is estimated that 180,000 German Jews were killed. To that, there were 250,000 mentally or physically disabled German children and adults. All children under 3 who were suffering from illnesses or disabilities such as Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, or suspected idiocy were initially targeted. They were taken away for treatment, and their parents later told they had died of pneumonia and that their bodies had been cremated to stop the spread of disease. This program was then expanded to include adults with disabilities, chronic illnesses, and mental health problems. It is thought that in total the number of civilian deaths was around 11 million. The victims included political activists, gay people, priests, communists, trade unionists, Jehovah's Witnesses, anarchists, Poles, Roma, other Slavic people, black people, and resistance fighters. I'm not listing these deaths to excuse Assad. There are no good guys in Syria, just varying shades of darkness. But you cannot start a sentence with, even Hitler didn't. Now for sarin and chemical weapons. It was invented by German scientist Gerhard Schroeder. His original work at Bayer was with organophosphates to make insecticides, in particular for aphids, during which time he synthesized the compound Tabun. He and his assistant became very dizzy with severe difficulty seeing and breathing after they both became accidentally exposed to one drop spilt on a lab table. It took them 3 weeks to fully recover. They had discovered the first nerve gas, and he was transferred to a German chemical weapons program. Over 12,000 tons of Tabun were manufactured during the war. When the factories were captured by the Soviets, the Tabun was poured into the Oder River, the factories dismantled, and sent back to the USSR for their chemical weapons program. During the next few years, other nerve gases were produced by the German team, including sarin and soman. Sarin was named after its discoverers, Schroeder, Otto Ambrose, Gerhard Ritter, and von der Lindt. It works as an off switch for the body's glands and muscles, with victims dying because they are no longer able to breathe. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention call sarin the most volatile of NERD agents, as it kills within seconds. It's thought that the Germans had produced 7,000 tons during the war. So why didn't Hitler order its use? German soldiers were ordered to fight to the last man, and there was no compunction against using carbon monoxide or Zyklon B in the gas chambers. It appears it was the horror of mustard gas in the First World War that held back both sides from deploying in the Second. But at the same time, the major players were stockpiling chemical and biological agents for retributive strikes. In December of 1943, an American supply ship, the SS John Harvey, carrying 2,000 mustard gas shells, was damaged in an air raid off Bari, Italy. More than 600 American personnel were exposed to the gas, 60 of whom died. An unknown number of Italian civilians also perished, but Allied commanders suppressed the story in case the Germans resorted to chemical weapons in response. And of course there is the infamous Grenade Island, which was contaminated with anthrax spores in 1942 by teams from Portadown, after which it was concluded it would take decades to decontaminate German cities if used. It was only after Operation Dark Harvest in 1981, which threatened to leave soil samples at appropriate points, did the serious work towards decontamination begin. The island was finally given the all clear on the 24th of April 1990, after 48 years of quarantine. The British government also tried to recruit Gerhard Schroeder in 1947, but he had gone back to Bayer and declined, saying, "I am glad to be fully engaged again in the field of plant protection. My work during the war in the field of toxic substances never complied with my wishes. I should like to assist improving nutrition, not inflicting new wounds." Hitler's chief chemical weapons engineer, Otto Ambros, was convicted of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Nuremberg in 1938, was sentenced to only 8 years in prison. He was held for three of these before moving to the United States to advise the US Army on its own sarin chemical weapons program. Sarin was adopted by NATO as a standard chemical weapon in the 1950s. Regular production of it ceased in the US in 1957, although existing stocks were redistilled until 1970. In 1953, 20-year-old Ronald Matheson, a Royal Air Force engineer, died in human testing of sarin at Portadown. The initial request it recorded misadventure, but when reopened in 2004, the jury ruled he had been unlawfully killed by the application of a nerve agent in a non-therapeutic experiment. The 1993 United Nations Chemical Weapons Convention was signed by 162 member countries, banning the production and stockpiling of many chemical weapons, including sarin. It went into effect on April 29th, 1997, and called for the complete destruction of all specified stockpiles of chemical weapons by April 2007. When the convention entered force, the parties declared worldwide stockpiles of 15,047 tons of sarin. Sarin has been used in both conflict and on civilian populations, in Hallujah, Iraq, Afar Peninsula, Matsumoto and Tokyo in Paris, Rif Damask in Syria, and this week allegedly in the Idlib province, Syria. The lack of knowledge and or briefing provided for the White House press secretary at such a time is not just disappointing, but frightening, and unfortunately quite typical of this administration. Since that outstanding PR disaster, the US has dropped a GBU-43B massive ordnance air blast bomb. It is the biggest non-nuclear bomb the US possess. I imagine arms manufacturers are delighted. Black-eyed son.
was riot, riot, revolution. Riot, riot, revolution. And when I get this feeling, I feel like kicking and screaming. 'Cause I'm lost in a crowd, I feel like shouting out loud. Riot, riot, revolution. Riot, riot, revolution. But you don't want rouge on your dry lips. Oh, sir, is that your son? With a lit cocktail and a copper gun. Riot, riot, revolution. Riot, riot, revolution.
Hi, my name's Steve McAuliffe. This is a poem called America the First. America, you taught the world how to be cool. You taught the world how to be cool and cruel. You gave us 100 different brands of chewing gum and 1,000 ways to spark the envy in other people's eyes. Then you gave us armies of armed prospectors fueled by the petrodollar onrush, the dirty gold rush, giving native types the bum rush time and time and time again. America, you consumed a quarter of the world's energy output in order to beam back at us a false projection of your idealized selves. America, you made a fetish of the sociopath and a crown for the psychopath. You gave this planet so much pain, you needed intensive psychoanalysis just to cope with it. But the advice you received was to lay the guilt at someone else's feet. And so you did, and wrote a best-selling book about how letting go became your liberation. So, you laid that guilt trip upon the rest of the world via manufactured coups, interventions and color revolutions. You blasted holes through the hearts of emerging nations, of re-emerging nations, and any attempt at wealth distribution was bombed at source, of course. And what of your grotesque half-time Super Bowl ceremonies and hamburgers that clog and choke the arteries? Someone once described America to me as a child with attention deficit disorder. I thought that was well out of order. No, America is more like an overindulged child who was never told no, even as he pulled the wings off butterflies and buried dog bones in the snow. In time, the child grows into the role of playground bully, threatening dreadful retribution to those who don't surrender their lunch money. Hell, it would be funny, America, if you didn't then moralise about how other people spend their break times. But who are we, at the end of the day, to talk about the false morality of vicious empire, here in old Europe, here in Great Britain, specifically here in jolly England, when we gave the world concentration camps and the strategy of tension, we also gave the world the myth of civilization, softened the jagged edges with backstabbing civility, strapping Indians to cannons and sparking firestorms in German cities. It's just a pity, America, that you don't dress your war criminals in sashes, gartered stockings and ermine, and transport them between palaces and golden carriages as the savages wave their plastic flags on plastic sticks upon the streets they can ill afford. America, your only truly arcane ceremonies are tucked away in forests where your effigies of giant Canaanite kings are asked to sanctify your latest burnt offerings. America, not a holy line of chosen kings as such, but a strong succession of pumped-up, jumped-up emperors exploding mighty bombs in desert wastelands to the tune of America the Great, America the Mighty, America the Blind and duped and scared shitless by its own fearful shadow. America, America. The snake oil salesman sold you laced Kool-Aid, courtesy of their CIA handlers. America, the clock is ticking, 'cause someone smuggled a thermonuclear device into the school playground. The clock is ticking, America. You now stand, self-aggrandizing and dangerously alone. The hapless teachers and cowering students all hold their breath as the bully hugs his fearful toy to his puffed-up chest and screams aloud, America first! America first! Into the waiting banks of eager microphones.